Hi, folks. Jack Spirko here with the next set of questions and answers for Chapter 1. I've got 4 questions today, so I expect it would be a pretty quick session, except the first one's actually pretty complex, and so is the fourth one, so we'll see how it goes. The first question that I have today in the questions and answers section for you is on the third ethic, and there's actually a lot of questions, so while I'm going to say the question that I'm answering is the third ethic return of surplus, or is it setting limits to population and consumption? I'll tell you that in this answer, I'll pretty much be answering all the questions on the third ethic that have come in so far. So there is this discrepancy in permaculture, and there's what I call the illegitimate discrepancy and the legitimate discrepancy. The illegitimate discrepancy is it return of surplus or redistribution of surplus? And I'll say for the sake of this PDC and the people that are teaching it, we stick to what Bill Mollison has developed over the years and the original intent of permaculture and the original intent of the ethics, and it is return. And I'm not even going to speak to redistribution other than maybe in my answer a little bit, because I'll show you how it doesn't work that way. It just, you don't create a sustainable system. Excuse me. You don't create a sustainable system with a redistribution model of surpluses. Okay. So let's start out with the way that Josiah taught this in our course here. That the first ethic is care of the earth. The second ethic is care of people. The third ethic is a return of surplus to the end of the first two ethics. So the return of surplus is designed to see to people care and earth care. And I talked about this quite a bit in the adjunct as well, which if you haven't seen the adjunctive videos yet, make sure you watch those. So we get that. But then there's this issue with a discrepancy in what is the third ethic that is straight out of the PRI in Australia. If you go in the Permaculture's Designer's Manual, which is your textbook really for permaculture, certainly for a PDC, you will see the third ethic expressed differently. You will see it as setting limits on population and consumption. So what's the deal? Which one is it? Well, part of this I'll chuck up to Bill Mollison, being who Bill Mollison is. And Bill, well, Bill is the kind of guy that will set traps for a student so that they can have a journey of self-discovery. For instance, Jeff Lawton told me when Bill gave him control of the first PRI, he basically said, here it is, go figure it out. And, you know, years later, he's finding these valves for water. And if you turn the valve one way, water goes one way, and you turn it the other way, water goes the other way, and Jeff said he's sitting there going, Bill, what are you doing to me? You know, and it was setting up this opportunity for discovery that made Jeff a better permaculturist. So Bill might be doing a little bit of the twinkle of the bearded old man eye thing there with us with this. But I really don't think so. To me, the two ethics are really one and the same, though on some levels I almost wonder, is it four ethics? Do we, you know, because both are sanctioned by the PRI. And it's proper to teach them both ways. I'll try to build the bridge between the two for you. This is complicated. So let's start out with how return of surplus works and why it actually is a design principle, not just an ethics principle. So if I have a cow, and that cow lives on a small little farm stead of mine that I'm managing with permaculture principles, that cow has needs and that cow has outputs. And some of those outputs become a surplus, like manure. Now, if I redistribute that manure, it's possible that someone will do the right thing with it, but it's also possible I might redistribute it downstream in the form of excess nitrates and pollute groundwater. And there's also a cost of redistribution. And then the fertility in that cow's manure largely came from the grazing that cow did on my property. So if I export the manure and redistribute the surplus, and we don't even get into the political connotations of it, just a simple mechanical redistribution, all of that fertility is lost. And that means to replace that fertility, I have to bring in input. So immediately I break down from a sustainable system to an unsustainable system by not following the ethic. The surplus must be returned and thought of as an investment, is the best way to think of it. Does that mean there's no surplus for sharing? There's no surplus in the form of a profit? No, but what it means is we have to look at each surplus and individually decide what happens to it, and the significant surpluses must be reinvested to the end of the first two. Again, care of people, care of the earth. So how do we get from there to setting limits on populations and consumptions? And hopefully, again, I'll build this bridge for you so it'll make sense. Let's imagine, again, now we have our small farmstead, a 3-acre piece of land like my personal piece of land, and I want to put a cow on that piece of land. No problem. No problem at all. My piece of land, kind of marginal for it right now as it's being developed. I probably won't own a cow. I don't want all the work of owning a cow. But yet, I could put one cow on a 3-acre piece of land. And I could rotate that cow with grazing, and I would create a manure surplus, and I could deal with it. I could also use the surpluses of the land to support the cow. So I can grow enough grass and grazing matter here to support one cow on 3 acres. Technically, in the right landscape, the right climate, I should be able to support 3 cows on 3 acres. It's possible. One cattle unit per acre in general on good, lush land. Here, 2 on my property. It's kind of like an edge between temperate and desert climate. I could probably get away with 2. Right now, we're supporting a population of chickens on our property, about 60 of them. We have no problem doing that. Now, we are having to bring in feed, but over time, this system can actually support that many birds. But it can't support, it absolutely cannot support a population of, let's say, 20 cows or 200 to 300 chickens. It's too much. We would exceed the land's carrying capacity, and we would begin to squander the surpluses. In fact, we would begin to create scarcities in the surpluses that we need and excesses in the surpluses that are damaging to us. Excess manure, more manure than we can handle on this piece of property and process and take responsibility for its surplus in and of ourselves. The surpluses of the land's productivity would be stripped down bare by an excessive population of the animals. Also, we have to look at the land's carrying capacity for human beings. We could probably move in a family of 4 to 6 people on this piece of property. And if we got everything bang on right, with the exception of certain things that we'd want for luxuries and things like that, we could probably produce enough protein, carbohydrate, and fat off of this 3-acre piece of land, about a half acre dedicated per human here. We could probably, in time, with the right budget and with the right design, deal with all of the waste that these people would produce, myself and 5 other individuals. But we can't put 50 people on this piece of land. We can't do that sustainably. Not if we're going to provide the majority or even a significant quantity of the calories for all of the people on this piece of land. Can we put 50 people on 3 acres and expect that we're going to do that? So we have to set a limit in our design to how many beings can exist on a piece of property. And it applies, whether we want it to or not, it applies to every living thing on that piece of property. Let's look at it a completely different way with something that doesn't make noises when you kill it, right? Because when we kill the extra cow, people feel bad for the cow. People tend not to feel that bad for cutting something down like, let's say, a tree. Now, if it's a big, monumentous tree that's been in the forest for thousands of years and cannot be replaced, we shouldn't cut it down. And we should let that tree reach its natural life cycle end, and then and only then put it to use as timber. I completely believe that. But if we look at a piece of property and it's completely overgrown with trees, to where the trees are like this close to each other, and all the trees are about as big around as my wrist, yet they're 25 feet tall, we know full well that we have to thin that population out. So we'll thin and set a limit to the population of trees on that property so that they can be productive, so they can generate surplus, they can be reinvested to the end of supporting people and making the earth healthy and not harming the earth. So we would gladly thin some of those trees out in that situation so that we could accomplish the design and care for the earth and care for people. If we turn around, though, and say, okay, well, right now there's no trees here. We can plant whatever we want here. Well, we probably wouldn't plant trees at a density of one tree per inch. We might actually get something close to that kind of crazy with forest establishment in certain areas with certain stacking functionalities, probably not per inch, but maybe per foot. But we know full well going in that population is an establishmentary population, and as the growth comes up, the population has to be thinned out, chop and drop. So we know that in the end, when we get into overstory climax forest, we can only have so many productive trees and only have so many support species before we have to break down on the next level of layers and go into understory trees, and then we have to do things like develop our shrub layers or herbaceous layers and things like that. And every single element in those designs has a carrying capacity on the land. And it's up to us as designers to understand those limits, to harness them, and to work within those limits. Because if we don't, nature has a way of figuring out how to do it for us. And a lot of times we end up with what we call problems and nature calls solutions. And in that situation, we begin to design ourselves out of the equation. The land no longer supports us. We lose control of it, and it does what it wants through the expansion of edges. And that really is all related to this third ethic. This third ethic of taking the surplus and redistributing it. Not redistributing it. I can't believe I said that. Reinvesting it and returning it to the land. Returning it to the land so that it can continue to grow in fertility. Now, the way we make those two work together, and I've been trying to like explain this in a way that will make sense, is that we understand that the carrying capacity of the land is directly related to whether that land produces in surplus or begins to decline. And it is one of those things where, I'll put it to you this way, the next time that I have Jeff Lawton on my podcast, I will be saying, please to explain how both you and Bill have taught the third ethic phrased two different ways. And we'll see how close I am to it. This is the best I can do for you here. It really is. But in the end, the third ethic as expressed, setting limits to population and consumption, directly addresses the two concerns of the first two ethics, caring for the earth and caring for people. If we exceed the carrying capacity of the land, either in vegetation, animal, or human, we begin to damage the earth and we begin to fail to provide people care. Okay? If we don't return the surplus to the system, it becomes unsustainable and we damage the earth and we damage the care of people. So, in essence, we express it one way or the other to the same end, the stability of the first two. That is the best I can do for you guys on that one. It's not an easy one. Another question, okay, and the next question is a nonprofit in line with permaculture principles, is it unsustainable because it relies on donations? So a lot of people in the permaculture world, when they set up a business and they decide, I'm going to help save the world, say to themselves, I need to do a nonprofit. I can't be an evil company making lots and lots of money and be in permaculture. It's incongruent. There's no way those two things can possibly go together. The reality is, well, permaculture creates abundance, and abundance in an economic system results in a profit. So a permaculture system, if run properly, should be profitable. So that profit can exist in a variety of ways. It can exist on a farm run for profit, specifically for the purpose of economic gain, so it can provide a living for the family on there, or it can be run for a profit of providing them with the food that they need so that they don't need to work for that food. It can be at any level that they want it to be. We can run a permaculture system with something like a church, and that church would be a nonprofit just based on legalities and issues around it. But the profit of that system may be food for the congregation and the community that's supported by that congregation, and that's okay. The reality is nonprofit, as it exists as a legal structure, is just that, is a legal structure. And to think that nonprofit means does not make money is wrong. It's what happens with the money. So money comes into a nonprofit. Much of it goes to pay salaries. I promise you, the CEOs of many nonprofits in America, especially big nonprofits, like let's say the American Red Cross, probably spend a lot of time flying around in private jets. They make just as obscenely high, ridiculous amounts of money as people that run for-profit corporations. It's the company's purpose. It exists to fill a function, serve a role that has a tax status of being non-taxable as long as it continues to fill that role. The real purpose of a nonprofit is so the company can maintain accrued earnings for future work without facing a tax consequence. And so that it can entice people to support its mission through donations, because those donations in of themselves are tax-free. So when you're making a determination of what structure to make a business, so I'm not really answering the question yet, I understand that, but it's important to understand this. When I'm deciding, do I do a C-Corp? Do I do an LLC? Do I do an LLP? Do I do a limited partnership? Do I do a nonprofit? What type of nonprofit? There's multiple. What structure do I set a company up with? That's a conversation to have with a tax attorney and a CPA. That is not something you make a decision on based on whether or not you personally believe profit is good or bad. Right? Profit is evil. I'm going to do nonprofit. It's not a smart way to do things. If you really just feel that profit is evil, you can run a for-profit corporation, you can pay all of the money out to yourself, there'll be no profit left in the company at the end of the tax year, and you can donate that money to, I don't know, Kites for Orphans or whatever floats your boat. And you can do, you know, it's up to you what happens with the proceeds of the business. This is a legal decision. This is a tax structure decision. This is a corporate business decision and should be treated as such. But is a nonprofit inherently unsustainable because the business does not have, let's say, a relationship that involves produce, deliver, charge, bring revenue in? I say absolutely not. I know that might shock some people who are familiar with me and my work, but nonprofits do have customers. And they're not the people that they serve with their mission. So let's say I set up a business. And I set up that business for the purpose of helping homeless people. And I say, to help homeless people, I'm going to set up this company, Jack's Homeless Kitchen. And my kitchen is going to serve meals to the homeless. In a conventional looking at a business model, you'd say, well, the customer then is the homeless man that comes in, he sat down, he's talked to, we minister to him in some way. It doesn't have to be a religious ministry, but some sort of, if you're doing a business like that, we would hope that it was more than just, here's a meal, eat it, and get out. Why are you on the street? How can we help you? We work with other organizations, that type of thing. Where are you going to be sleeping tonight? And nothing else, we've put a meal in your belly. And please come back. And as long as we're here, there's always a place for you to come get a meal. Great. But he's not my customer. He didn't buy anything. The customer is the person that says, I believe that someone should feed homeless people and give them a place that's safe and give them a place that they feel good, and that organization should exist and it should do whatever it can to help people, and that it should do whatever list of things that I feel should be done. And then along comes Jack's Homeless Kitchen, right, and says, we do those things. And then that person says, aha, they're doing the things that I want done. So I'm going to take my money, and I'm going to give it to them to fill their mission. That person is my customer. And I can run a business like that, and if I'm smart about how I run that business, I return some of the surplus donations to the business to make sure that my customer base is aware of the fact that I am fulfilling the mission I promised them I would fulfill. So I might have a Facebook page or a photo gallery that shows people being fed. I might put out some YouTube videos showing our volunteers working, and not only using it to tell the person that's giving me a donation that we're doing the right things, the things we promised that we would do, but also to attract volunteers. Because I need volunteers in that organization. I also need employees. So to attract people to help me further my mission and to find partnerships. So you really run a nonprofit business from a legal and tax structure and from a cash flow structure slightly different than a conventional business, but the rules of business still apply. So a business is sustainable based on its ability to build capital, both financial, social, cultural, experiential, etc. You can look up the 8 forms of capital by Ethan Rowland if you want to look at all of those. And a nonprofit just has a different way that it lines out those forms of capital. It certainly can be sustainable. It certainly can be as sustainable as any business that depends on a cash flow. Let me put it to you that way. And it certainly would not be out of line with permaculture principles. But it doesn't mean that a for-profit corporation is out of line. So it's not like one or the other. It's whatever works best for the mission at hand. Then the next question is on greening the desert. It says, are there other examples of greening the desert? Would West Texas be a good place to do this domestically? Should we all do something like Jeff Lawton's doing with greening the desert? And then I have another question with a completely different take on this next to answer. But the answer is there are people all over America in desert climates doing permaculture. And some of the most awesome permaculture is being done in high desert environments. I'm going to save my opinion of, let's say, West Texas junk land for a little bit here, because that's going to tie into the next question on greening the desert. But I would tell you this. The reason that Jeff did the Greening the Desert project was twofold. One, they worked with what they had. It was the land that they were given in Jordan when they said, give us some land and we'll show you what permaculture can do. And they said, fine, here's this rock in the desert. Do something with it. So they worked with what they had, which is a big part of the lesson there. The other reason they did it, though, was as an example. So there is a lot to be gained from taking a piece of true, harsh desert and with proper design, making it highly productive. I will tell you this. If it were not for the Greening the Desert project, it is very possible that you would not be listening to me right now answer these questions as a teacher in permaculture. Jeff's Greening the Desert did exactly what it was supposed to do for me. It opened me up to what was possible. I had already discovered Bill Mollison a little bit, and I was already intrigued, and I might have ended up down this path anyway. But when I saw Greening the Desert, I thought to myself, if you can do that there, imagine what I can do in a temperate climate with 35 inches of rain. I should be able to blow it up. So, yeah, there's other examples. As far as West Texas, let me give you the next set of questions. It's all rolled into one, and I think that will answer it for you right there. So, this question is a bunch rolled into one. What role do natural deserts play in ecology? Should all deserts be reversed? Isn't worrying about the deserts like worrying about oil production? Isn't it better to start in your own backyard? Basically, like, so, hey, you know, hey, there's deserts everywhere. And we can't worry about, like, undeserting all the deserts, right? So what role, first of all, are there natural deserts? Are there deserts that have always been deserts? If you went back in time before human beings and walked there, you'd see a desert. Yeah. Absolutely. Sure there are. And you're honestly speaking of things like, you know, Death Valley and the Mojave and the Sahara when you were there. And these native deserts, if you want to call them that, that are the harshest natural deserts out there, very little life in them, are actually a very small fraction of the total deserts, including, again, I guess you'd call it native deserts, in America and around the world. There are deserts all over the place. And a desert is pretty much any place that gets less than 10 inches of rain a year is considered a desert climate. So there's deserts all over the place that have anything from forest to scrub to low-lying things to cacti. I mean, there's tremendous numbers of and tremendous diversity in desert climates. When we talk about the problem of desertification in permaculture and reversing that, we're not really speaking to native deserts unless they're damaged native deserts. We're talking about places that weren't always a desert and places that maybe were a desert but were very full of life and very diverse and had scrub desert forest habitats and were able to sustain people and animals at high levels, and now they've been damaged from things like cotton farming to support the World War II war effort in the United States. There's plenty of places now that you go look at them and go, oh, it looks like it was always a desert here. And it was, but it was a much more diverse, thriving, living desert. In Arizona, we have the saguaro cactuses that used to be basically a cactus forest. You know, or I guess maybe more accurately would be a cacti forest. And we know that the last of those will be gone soon. So when we talk about reversing desertification, we're not really talking about going out to a place that's completely barren and has always been that way and turning it into a paradise. Though we can, I don't think it's the best use of our resources. I agree with the spirit of this question. We're more talking about repairing the damage to places that weren't deserts or at one time were productive deserts that have now been through erosion and damage made into non-productive deserts. So, you know, then when we look at the next part of this question, so is worrying about deserts like worrying about oil production? In other words, they're going to, like I've said in the adjunctive video, they're going to pump the oil. We can sit around and worry about that, or we can reduce our own energy usage and we can develop sustainability for ourselves, an example to others, and accept the fact that it's a long tail of pulling off of the cheap energy solution and that we can't just put solar panels everywhere and turn off the oil wells. It's not practical. It's not possible. There's a major timeline and technology development line necessary now that we have a global population with 8 billion people, roughly, that we can't just flip the switch. So shouldn't I look at, you know, deserts the same way and just work in my own backyard? I say if you have the opportunity to do permaculture in the tropics, do it in the tropics. If you have the opportunity to do permaculture in a northeast temperate forest climate with big, deep, beautiful black soils, do it there. If you have the opportunity to do an edge and scrub desert, do it there. Do it in the place that makes sense for you. I completely agree with that. That doesn't mean that we don't worry about these desert situations and desertification, though. Because as permaculturists, we have multiple roles that we fill. You're going to notice as you go through this course that occasionally you're going to be getting information about something and go, I don't think that applies to me. I feel like I'm back in high school and the teacher's telling me that I need to learn calculus and I know damn well I'm never going to use calculus, so why do I have to learn about this? For instance, in a future lesson, when you're learning about different situations, you'll learn about dealing with permaculture and island habitats, and you'll learn about the freshwater lens of freshwater that forms underneath islands and how that has to be protected. And you might think to yourself, well, I don't plan on going to the South Pacific, so this doesn't really apply to me. With permaculture, we are trying to make you both a good designer and practitioner, but we're also trying to make you a good teacher. When you get done with this PDC, you're not done. You're not able to just fix everything, design everything, do everything. Some of you guys are taking a PDC for the third or fourth time. I've taken multiple PDCs. I've helped taught multiple PDCs. They are transformational experiences. But in the end, there is enough academic knowledge that if you really take it in, I should be able to take a helicopter, stick you in it, fly you somewhere, drop you off, and you should be able to look around, know how to talk to people as long as you can get past the language barrier, look at the landscape profiles, do an energy audit, sector analysis, zone things out, and you should be able to start designing a system and make whatever's there better than it is and begin a pathway towards sustainability. Doesn't mean you'll get everything right. Doesn't mean you won't make any type 1 errors. It means that you should be able to start a system into the implementation phase very quickly anywhere in the world. So if we don't worry about desert climates and desertification, then we leave that out. So if my magical helicopter dropped you off in an edge desert environment, you wouldn't know what to do, which means PDC has failed because it hasn't given you the academic requirements set forth by the PRI to make it valid. So we're going to make sure you have that. But the problem of desertification is much different, in my view, than the problem of fossil fuel usage. And here's why. You can't really, as an individual, have a great impact on how much oil Shell or BP pumps. You really can't. You can trick yourself into believing, well, I carpooled when I went to my PDC, so I saved carbon or whatever. But you really didn't do that much. I'm sorry, you didn't do that much. It really didn't change anything about oil production on that day. And one or two people, or 10 people, or frankly 100 people, to get together and figure out we're never going to use oil again is a great thing. It's a great example. It's a message that can spread, and it should be done. But in the end, if those people don't get other people to follow their example, their actions will mean very, very little. One person with the time and the dedication can take a piece of land, anything from 1 acre to 1,000 acres, and reverse desertification. It's something you can do if you choose to. I'm not saying everybody will, or even that everybody should, but I'm saying, unlike affecting the price of oil, light sweet Texas crude's pricing, you're not going to affect it. Not even over your entire life as an individual. Remember in my adjunct, they said it's a fool's mission if you go that way. And then you become depressed because you realize that all the things that you've worked for didn't accomplish much. And again, they do if they serve as an example to others and if others follow them. But again, we've got this long tail, this long winding down from an industrialized society to a more agrarian one. And I do think that's our future, but it's going to take a while to get there. But if you go out and get your hands on 20 acres of land, progressing toward desert, becoming desert, say, we're going to stop this first. We're going to examine this. We're going to understand this landscape. We're going to examine the energy flows into this piece of property. We're going to determine where the wind is blowing away the soil. We're going to determine where the water is being eroding the soil. We're going to stop it. We're going to learn the land's contours. We're going to learn to harmonize with this landscape. We're going to figure out the carrying capacity of this land. We're going to start managing it first and foremost with the three ethics: earth care, people care, return of surplus. Then for that piece of land, you can change the entire climatic type of that piece of land. If you're in a desert, you can take it from non-productive to productive desert. But if you're not in a native desert climate, you're just on a piece of land that became desert, you can actually turn it back into what it was. So you're not going to slow down the oil pump, but you can slow down the encroachment of the desert. And the last thing I'll leave you with on today's Q&A is this. Part of the reason we study some of the things that you might not ever directly do, you might not ever set up a septic system on an island and have to worry about the freshwater lens and contaminating it. The more systems you know about, the more systems you understand, from the tropics to the desert to the temperate, the cool temperate, the warm temperate, the arid, the humid, the more systems you understand, no matter what system you're working in, the more effective you're going to be. And that is definitely the case. And probably the one thing you can learn about that will give you the most skill as a designer, even if you're not operating in that biome or climate, is deserts. If you can learn how to design a desert system, or a system that halts, stops, and reverses desertification, then you can design a system that prevents it. You can go into a place that's not a desert and you can make it uber productive. It's probably one of the most valuable things in the permaculture wardrobe, is understanding desert climates and halting, stopping, and reversing desertification. Anyway, guys, with that, keep the questions coming. No one's done this yet, so again, I'm going to ask you, please consider, when you put your question down, type in all capital letters, question, dash, and then type your question. Try to make your question short, concise, and direct. That'll help us do a better job answering your questions. Enjoy progressing through this PDC. If you struggle with some of the academia that's presented along the way, remember, we've built this course in accordance with the guidelines of the PRI. And some of it has to be there. And all of it has a purpose and all of it has a reason. And it might be that it won't be until you complete, let's say, Chapter 10, that you're thinking back to Chapter 3 and going, oh, that's why that was there. Or that you'll take a walk across your property and you'll have an epiphany and go, oh, now I get it. Keep exploring. Keep learning. Keep driving forward. And again, if you need something, let us know. We'll do what we can to help you out.
Answer, I'll pretty much be answering all the questions on